On the 13th of August 2009, while serving with the 2nd Rifles in Afghanistan, Captain Mark Hale was killed in action in Afghanistan. His unit was providing security for a meeting of local leaders in the Sangin area, and Mark was searching a mosque looking for ammunition when one of his comrades triggered an IED, an improvised explosive device. A second explosion followed, and Mark was wounded as he tried to help the casualties and died later of his injuries at Camp Bastion. In a tribute to Mark, his commanding officer, a man called Lieutenant Colonel Rob Thompson, said he was undentable, and we in 2 Rifles have invented this new word in honour of Mark. Nothing fazed him, however demanding the situation, and his ability to absorb work, pressure and other people's worries was genuinely legendary. This is what undentable now means. And Mark had been married to a lady called Brenda for 22 years, and they had 2 daughters together. The youngest of them, Alex, was still at prep school. So the Army Benevolent Fund supported Alex and her family. And she described the charity's support during her childhood as providing continuity in a world that for myself, my sister and my mum had changed forever. And since then, Alex has taken part in numerous fundraising challenges and events, and she now serves as an ambassador for the charity. She's worked in Brussels in EU public affairs, and she's now based in London, where she works in international policy and relations at the FCA, the Financial Conduct Authority. When her dad died, Alex was just 8 years old, and 16 years later, she's now an adult. And last week, over 3 long, gruelling days, Alex joined nearly 50 other people towards the ABF's annual frontline walk across the World War I battlefields. From the gigantic Lochnagar crater, they made their way across the old 1916 Somme battlefields, all the way up to Hebuterne. On day 2, it was a dawn start at the Vels and Vast German Cemetery. And that was followed by 2 exhaustive climbs up the hill to the French National Cemetery at Notre Dame de Lorette. Then after lunch, it was another climb up to Vimy Ridge. On day 3, it was another early start, beginning at Vancouver Corner and ending at the Menin Gate, where Alex was part of a wreath-laying party. And as they laid the wreath on behalf of the charity, Alex was surrounded by 54,000 names of the missing from the Ypres salient. She showed little outward emotion as she made her way up the steps, bowed her head, and then walked back into line in single file behind the other members of the party. But inside, I'm sure she was a sea of emotions. And in this episode of my podcast, Tales from the Battlefield, with me, Terry Wenham, we follow Alex and the other frontline walkers on the walk itself, and we hear the stories that they discovered along the way. A couple of years ago, after the 2023 frontline walk, we did a similar podcast. It was a similar route, but in this episode, we're going to be looking at different stories to what we looked at then, as we uncovered more information about those soldiers that fought in the Great War. We begin our story at the Arras Memorial, on the day before the walk began, where I discovered 2 brothers from Northampton who died on the same day during the Battle of Arras, alongside each other. In the background, you can hear that famous hymn being sang, Abide With Me. And the recording that you're listening to was made whilst Alex and Philippa Calcutt and Derek Saunders were laying the wreath at the last post ceremony at the Menin Gate. And it was being sang by the military wives, which in the circumstances was more than appropriate.
Thank you.
So I'm now looking at bay number 5 at the Arras Memorial here. To the left of me stands the enormous Cross of Sacrifice. I think there are 4 different sizes of Cross of Sacrifice, and that's the largest one that I can see to my left along the busy main road on the suburbs of Arras. And on bay 5 I'm looking at a sea of names, as you always do, and above my head there's a bit of a mistake that was made by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, because there were 2 brothers called William and Edward Inwood, who came from my hometown of Northampton, lived at number 30 Leicester Street in Northampton, and they were serving together in the 4th Battalion of the East Yorkshire Regiment. But on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, it says that one of them, William, was serving with the Yorkshire Regiment. But they died on the same day, these 2 lads. And therefore, their names should be together. But they're not. They definitely served in the same regiment, in the same battalion even. In fact, they were serving alongside each other when they were killed in action on the 23rd of April 1917. So when I look for the Yorkshire Regiment, just the Yorkshire Regiment, I look down rows and rows and columns of privates. And then near the foot of the panel, it says Inwood W, William Inwood. Newspaper tells us he was 37 years old, serving with the East Yorkshires, not the Yorkshires. Eldest son of Mr. and Mrs. Inwood, killed in action, and he worked for Messrs. Singlehurst and Sons. And then a few yards to my left, but listed under the East Yorkshires, which is correct, that's where both of them were serving, I can see about halfway down an Inwood on his own, E.G. Inwood, Edward G. Inwood, died on the 23rd of April that day again, 1917. Son of Mr. and Mrs. Inwood, 30 Leicester Street, went to the front in September of 1916, and he worked for a different firm, still in the boot and shoe trade, a company called Swan in Brockton Street in Northampton. So those 2 brothers would have joined up together, maybe they were conscripted together. 12 years apart, William was 12 years older than his brother Edward, no doubt. William would have taken Edward under his wing, being the younger brother. But on that day, on the 23rd of April 1917, they both died, and out there their bodies are buried somewhere, probably. They should be here together on the Arras Memorial to the Missing, but they're not. They're a few yards apart, but hopefully their spirits, their souls, are together somewhere. So it's dawn on day 2 of the 2025 Army Benevolent Fund Frontline Walk. And this is always a tough day for the walkers. I've done this many times. It's a day that takes us across the French and then the British and Canadian battlefields. But where I'm standing now is not far from Arras, only about 10-15 minutes drive from Arras. And it's called Neuville St. Vaast German Military Cemetery. There's an information board outside the cemetery which quotes a man called Albert Schweitzer, Nobel Peace Prize laureate. And he's quoted as saying, "The soldiers' graves are the greatest preachers of peace." And as I speak, there's rumours that the war between Israel and Palestine, it's going to be a ceasefire there. And that was the thought that came into my head, that not just in that case the soldiers' graves, but the graves of all those civilians that have died there, the greatest preachers of peace. And I'm sure that everyone, not just there, but out in Ukraine as well, would appreciate some peace. But coming back to the First World War, the war cemetery here was established by the French military authorities just after the war, between 1919 and 1923. And it's the German equivalent to a concentration cemetery, where many of the smaller cemeteries that the Germans had established during the war were exhumed, the bodies there were exhumed and brought here
from regions north and east of Arras. And this is in fact the largest German World War I site anywhere in France. There's a bigger one at Menin in Belgium, slightly bigger. The German equivalent of the War Graves Commission is, I can't pronounce it in German, but let's call it the German War Graves Commission, the VDK. They redesigned and reorganised the site here between 1975 and 1983. But they're not funded like we are through taxpayers' contributions. It's a charity. It depends on donations and contributions to maintain and take care of the grounds of the cemetery. Young people from all over Europe meet in international youth camps to lend a hand and to build bridges of understanding and communication. And bodies were brought here from over 110 parishes around the Department of Calais, who'd previously been buried either in field graves or in small temporary grave sites. The dead, the German dead that lie here, died in heavy fighting in the Artois region around Lorette and Vimy Ridges between August 1914 and 1917. The site is now the final resting place of an incredible, listen to this, 44,830 German soldiers killed in action, and the cemetery here was open to the public as recently as November 1983. And the information board at the bottom, it says, the dead of this cemetery admonish to peace. And as anyone who's visited a German cemetery anywhere on the Western Front will tell you, it's a very different experience to visiting a British cemetery. And as soon as you enter through an iron gate, this sea of crosses opens out in front of you. There's a number of trees that, as it's now October in Northern Europe, the trees are changing colour very gradually. They're going from green to brown, and some of them have already fallen to the ground. They've fallen between these iron crosses that are here in what is another silent city, despite the fact there's a main road next to it with busy commuter traffic tearing up and down. And when we come to these crosses, we see that all of them is not a cross for one soldier, but at least two. Frederick Fahrer died on the 14th of September 1916, and he shares a cross with an unknown soldier. And then next to them is Michael Gefreiter, who's died March 1918 during that German spring offensive. And he's buried in the same grave as Hermann Peiner, who died on the 16th of March 1918. And it occurs to me as I look at all of these crosses here in the cemetery that many of these soldiers would have died, obviously in awful circumstances, but perhaps nowhere near here. They're not buried close to where they've died, but they've been brought here, concentrated, 44,000 of them, in this very solemn place. The British cemeteries, designed to look like an English country garden, that was one of the original ideas of Lutyens and his colleagues. And the other thing that you see here that you won't see if you visit a German World War II cemetery is scattered amongst the crosses are different headstones. Headstones that are made of stone. A solid structure with a curved top. And on top of those headstones, quite often, is a stone. Or more than one stone. And the first thing you see on the top of those headstones is the Jewish Star of David. And that tells us that the soldier, and the one I'm looking at now, Max Vollenberg, who died on the 22nd of September 1918, was Jewish. There are many, many Jewish headstones in this cemetery scattered around. And it seems incredible, doesn't it, that just a generation after these Jewish German soldiers laid down their life for their country, that had they survived the war, that they would have been perceived by the Nazis as the enemy. And I've read stories in Auschwitz and other concentration camps of decorated First World War German Jewish soldiers being persecuted, being taken to the gas chambers, having their medals with them, perhaps the Iron Cross, showing it to the SS in the hope that it would mean that them and their families would be spared the gas chambers. But it made no difference. Stories go that I've read that the SS just laughed at them and shoved them in the gas chambers the same way that everybody else went. Moritz Wassenhut, the 7th of August 1915, another Jewish man with two stones. And I believe that the stones on top of Jewish graves means it's telling the dead soldier, the dead person, that someone's been to see them. It's a token. Man can be very horrible to fellow man. Always has been and always will be, I suppose. War will never end. Conflict will never end. It really is a stark reminder. Again, Martin Schnopek died on the 23rd of March 1918, another Jewish soldier. I rest my hand on the top of his headstone, where there is no stone. But he knows that I've been to see him, hopefully, because I've just rested my hand there and we're talking about him now, aren't we? And the crosses go on, seemingly forever and ever. But that's not all, because at the back of the cemetery are mass graves. I think most of the German cemeteries on the Western Front contain plots where there are mass graves. We don't see those in the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries. But space was an issue here, and other factors as well. The names are listed, if they know them, of those soldiers that are in there on panels. They also deserve to be remembered, don't they? The frontline walkers have now moved on. They've got a tough morning this morning. They've got some very steep climbs. They're walking through the French battlefield of 1915 and 1916. They're going to find it tough today. Number of very steep inclines. They're going to be sore and hurting from yesterday. But what drives them on is the memory of these soldiers, not just from the United Kingdom, from the Commonwealth country, but from France and from Belgium and also from Germany. So important that we remember the sacrifices from all nations in the Great War. That's what this podcast is about. That's what remembrance is all about. And that's what the front line is all about. And also, it's about raising money, of course, for the Army Benevolent Fund. There are many, about half of the people, there's 44 people taking part in the walk this year. About half of them are veterans, British veterans, who have, some of them have seen conflict. Maybe they've lost friends. Later on, we're going to be hearing from one of the walkers, a young lady who lost her father when she was 8 years old, serving in the British Army in Afghanistan. We're going to hear from her and why she's here on the frontline walk. The birds, I can now hear as I make my way away from the main road, the birds are singing. It's very still, there's no wind. But as I say, the trees, there's no flowers here, that's the other thing. It's a very solemn place, as opposed to those beautiful English gardens that we'll be seeing later on today. No flowers, just dark trees. And as I say, it's a beautiful sight, isn't it? when the trees change colour in the autumn, or the fall as they call it, across the Atlantic. And as I said at the beginning, a number of those leaves have fallen on the crosses of those German warriors. As we leave them now and we move on day two of the frontline walk. In Akouve Cemetery, in plot 5, just as you come in through the entrance by the Stone of Sacrifice, there's 14 headstones with the same date, 27th of May 1918. And most of these lads were killed when they came out of the front line and went into billets, which was also a dressing station, on the 25th of May 1918 at Mont Saint Eloi, at the abbey where we're going for our tea break this morning. And there was wooden huts there that were being used as bullets, but at 4 a.m. on the morning of the 27th, the Germans began shelling their area, their billets, and one of the shells scored a direct hit at the far end of one of the wooden huts. 10 men were killed outright, 5 others died of wounds, and these are the headstones that I'm looking at now. A further 6 were severely wounded, and 10 others at the other end of the hut were only slightly wounded, so every single member of that hut was either killed or wounded. The war diary for that month gives an interesting insight into the conditions under which the personnel were working within that unit. And it says there was a lack of basic supplies. Don't forget, this is May 1918, so it's towards the end of the war. And seemingly indifference, it says, from those in higher authority reaches near farcical levels, because it says that the unit's tailor is poached by the National Concert Troupe. Now, I'm just surprised that, first of all, that the unit had a tailor. Why would you need a tailor? I don't know. One of the men whose headstones I'm looking at now died on that day, was serving with the Royal Army Medical Corps, David Rhys Evans. With a name like that, come as no surprise to you that he came from South Wales. It was his brother, Sapper Richard William Evans, was serving with the Royal Engineers. He died at home on the 1st of February 1916, and he's buried in Llanelli Cemetery. And once again, by looking at some of these headstones and the personal inscriptions, it really does bring a tear to your eye, really, if I just move the plant away. Private Andrew Mackison, Royal Army Medical Corps, who died that day. My boy, though sore my loss, I bear my cross, I know we'll meet again. And of course, his parents or his wife, whoever came up with those words, they'll be passed on now, and they will be together somewhere. Private A. Withers, another one, Royal Army Medical Corps, working at that dressing station. His mum and dad wrote, "Only good night, dear son, not farewell. Soon with you we shall dwell." The frontline walkers have moved on now. They were here a few minutes ago, passed through the cemetery. They're feeling their bones, they're feeling their legs. Mentally, they're challenged. But they move on now to the tea break. They've got to climb up to the place where these 15 men died. When we get there, I'll tell them the story, so that whilst they're eating their cereal bars and drinking their tea and energy drinks, they will know what happened in that same location. Just one story of the many that's in this cemetery. Akouve is military cemetery. We're in the shadow of Vimy Ridge. It's a very beautiful place. Commonwealth War Graves Commission gardener has just been cutting the grass. The plants are laid out beautifully, and it really is another one of those lovely silent cities. So I've now come to a very quiet cemetery, well off the beaten track, a place where I wouldn't have thought that many tour groups come to, because you can't easily get to it, because it's down a track, a farm track, that was once a railway line. And that's why this cemetery has been established here, because there was a railway station on that Villers Station Cemetery, a small village 11 kilometres northwest of Arras. It was begun by the French in 1915, and then the Commonwealth divisions turned up in July of 1916 and they had field ambulance positions here until September 1918, just a couple of months before the armistice. But it's, this area is mostly associated with the Canadian headquarters, the Canadian Corps. They had their quarters nearby, and many of the graves in several of the plots date from April 1917 and the Battle of Vimy Ridge. After the armistice, a few graves were brought in from isolated positions in the area. And in June of 1923, the French graves that were here were removed, and no doubt they're in the large national cemetery at Notre Dame de Lorette, where we're going to be going later on. And the cemetery, the beautiful cemetery that I'm looking at now, neatly tended, still a few roses out blooming, some purple flowers, not sure what they are, should know. But there are now 1,208 men from the Commonwealth that are buried here. But that's not all. Although the French graves were removed, there are actually 32 German graves here. And the cemetery was designed by one of the three main commission, Imperial War Graves Commission, as it was then, architect Sir Reginald Blomfield. And he was the same architect that designed the Menin Gates, which he famously said was the only one he was entirely satisfied with. But if he was here today with us, he would see, I'm sure he'd be very pleased to see how the commission have looked after his design. And with 1,200 stories here to tell, we've got a few that I want to share with you for the podcast. So let's go and have a look at some of those, shall we? This one. Lieutenant Norman Eden Walker, who was named by his middle name as Eden, 124th Canadian Pioneers, was aged just 20 on the 13th of April 1917, when the burial service was held here at 2:30 in the afternoon. We've got extracts from letters that were sent to his mother by his cousin and fellow officer of the same battalion, Philip Williams. And they were here when young Eden died and was buried. Said, I wrote you a letter yesterday, but since then I've got the awful news that Eden had been killed. When I was up there, I met a Lieutenant Wood who was slightly wounded by the same shell that killed poor Eden, so I got the exact story. Wood had been laying out Eden's party to clean out a trench and was returning along the top of the trench with another engineer officer towards the front line to look over another job when a whiz-bang hit near them. He took no notice of it but went on, and another hit a little closer. He then spoke to the other officer and they got down into the trench where they found Eden, Watson and an officer of another unit. He stayed there and the other officer went on. Several more shells came over, so they got down as low as possible, but one struck the side of the trench, killing Eden instantly and wounding the other three. This was the last shell that was fired. He was the only wounded, while the officer of the other unit died the next day. These are the exact details. I will send a flower from Eden's grave next chance I get to go up to the cemetery. Mrs. Moore tells me that Eden's death hit the Walkers very hard. It is a pity he was killed. He was so much loved by all his relation. Eden had a visitor from Canada in 2001. His third cousin, a man called Philip Gunyon, came here. And I'm standing here now looking at the photo of that young man. And again, the thoughts come into my mind of what he would have achieved in his life had he not died during the battle, just after the Battle of Vimy Ridge, on the 13th of April 1917. There isn't a flower in front of his grave now. There are some plants. And I wonder whether they did manage to send a flower back to his home in Canada. But as we walk round the cemetery, the plot that I'm in now, there's grave after grave, row after row of Canadians from the 9th and the 10th of April as they stormed Vimy Ridge that we're going to visit this afternoon. But in amongst them all are four men that didn't die in battle, and three of them are Canadians that were shot at dawn for cowardice. Private Harold George Carter, serving with the 73rd Battalion of the Canadians. He'd deserted once and was given 10 years imprisonment. He returned to his unit and unfortunately he repeated the offence and he was executed on the 20th of April 1917. And the other three are all from 1918. Another Canadian, Private Fairburn, he came from Ontario. He died 2nd of March 1918, aged 23, executed for desertion. And another man, Stephen Falls, from the 44th Canadian Unit, he was executed on the 19th of June 1918. He was already under a suspended sentence of death when he again repeated the offence and paid the ultimate price. As did a British man, Frank Bateman, from the 1st 4th Yorks and Lancs Regiment, died on the 10th of September 1918 at the age of 28. Came from Sheffield. He was a volunteer and he'd served at Ypres. Came down to the Somme where he was wounded and recovered, but now in 1917 he went absent. He was sentenced to 12 months in prison. That was suspended, went back to his unit. He was then sent back to England because he carried out, given himself a self-inflicted wound. But in 1918, having served for 3 years out here on the Western Front, he deserted again. 15 years imprisonment, suspended again, resulted. But not long after, he did it again, as his unit was going up to the trenches. Paid the ultimate price himself. His relatives back home were not told that he'd been shot at dawn. They were simply told he died on service. Again, I don't make any judgments about these men. How can I? I didn't know them. I don't know the circumstances. It's nearly 110 years later. But we do know that in 2006, those 306 men that were executed for desertion or cowardice were given a pardon. Another soldier here, Lieutenant John Armstrong, who was serving with the Canadian Engineers, killed in action on the first day of that battle at Vimy Ridge on the 9th of April 1917. Before the war, he'd been a surveyor for the Canadian government. And I remember going to Canada many years ago, and I knew it rang a bell because there's a mountain in the Rockies. And I remember the guide pointing it out and said that it was previously called Table Mountain, but had been renamed Mount Armstrong in memory of Lieutenant John Armstrong, who's buried here. And of course, the story goes on and on. 1,200 stories to tell. We haven't got time to tell them all. As I sit here on the wall of the cemetery, I look down, it's on a slight slope, and I can see headstone after headstone with that maple badge on, that maple flower on, the emblem of the Canadian infantry, who achieved so much at Vimy Ridge, so many lessons that had been learnt from the difficult battles of 1915 and 1916. The mistakes that were made in those were very much put right at Vimy, and we're going to have a whole podcast that looks at that. In the distance now, I can see the intrepid walkers of the Army Benevolence Frontline Walk heading towards the cemetery, and I believe that one of them has a relative that's buried here. So we're going to go and see if we can find out what that story is, and then we're going to find some evidence that the Canadians fought here by visiting the local village. So stay with us. As I wander around, just noticed another headstone without a Christian cross. By default, the headstones had Christian crosses on, unless the family decided that they didn't want a Christian cross, they wanted it replaced with something else. But on this headstone, it's noticeable because there's no religious emblem whatsoever. So perhaps they weren't religious, or perhaps the family lost faith because of the death of Private 789203 W. Forbes, 38th Battalion, Canadian Infantry, died at just 19 on the 13th of September 1917. Although it doesn't have a Christian cross on it, it does have a family inscription. It says, "The place made vacant in our home can never more be filled." The place made vacant in our home can never more be filled. They're words that don't come from the Bible, they don't come from any literature. They come straight from the parents of Private Forbes, straight from the heart of the parents of Private Forbes. And again, the thought goes through my head as they came from the other side of the Atlantic, from Canada. Did they ever get here to see his grave? Perhaps not. But I'm here today, and you're listening to this, and I place my hand on his headstone and think of him, and think of his parents and his family. So we're still in Villa Station Cemetery, and we've got Gail here, who's come all the way from California to look for a relative. And
look for five relatives, actually.
Five relatives, but one in particular in this cemetery. You've walked about 10 miles already this morning to find him on the Front Line Walk. And who was he?
It's my great-great-uncle, William Gray, Royal Field Artillery. He, I think he came over in May of 15, with his half-brother, my great-grandfather. And he survived until July of 1918. Sadly, he saw the worst. I mean, he was up at Delville Wood. I mean, he was artillery, so he wasn't.
Yep.
And Highwood and Passchendaele, the Scarp. Anyway, so.
And then he gets to like 3 months from the end, and his story comes to an end. We know he was blown up. So wagon line was hit by a German shell.
Yes, it said bombed. Mm. So I'm not sure what that means, but it killed the horses and him and two other.
Right, who were probably buried over there with him. And what does it mean to you coming on? I know you said you'd been here twice before, but you've walked here today and you're exhausted after a day and a half of the Front Line Walk, so your emotions must be running quite high, and you haven't had a drink.
I have not had a drink, but it's thrilling to be able to walk in the footsteps.
Because you've come a long way, haven't you?
Yes.
From, you know, the other side of the Atlantic for this moment. Mm-hmm. But it's not the end of it, because he's got a brother. Is it his brother, you said, that's on the Menin Gate?
His brother, my great-grandfather, is on the Menin Gate.
Right.
And so we'll be looking for him tomorrow.
We'll be arriving there tomorrow. When they didn't know them. But he's on the Menin Gate, and it'll be very momentous, because that'll be the end of the Front Line Walk tomorrow, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So you'll be feeling all the emotions and the pain of the Front Line Walk, but also the emotional feelings of finding your relative on the Menin Gate itself.
And the first time since the scaffolding has been removed.
Yeah, of course.
So this will be a first.
Yeah. Right. Well, thank you very much for that. And thank you to William for his service and sacrifice.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
So we've now reached Suave Valley Cemetery, near the village of Souchez, and between the French cemetery and the Notre Dame de Lorette, where we were just now, goes down into a dip into the valley, and then it heads back up to Vimy Ridge, where we're going to end the Front Line Walk on this day two, the hardest day of them all. And why is this particular cemetery named Suave Valley? Because it takes its name from French regiments which fought in the vicinity of this cemetery in that first winter of the war in 1914-1915. The cemetery was begun in May of 1916 and used until June of 1917, and it was damaged severely through shell fire, and there were some graves that were brought here in plot one after the armistice to turn it into a small concentration cemetery, but there is in total only 250 burials on this site from 1914 to 18. Over a quarter of them are unidentified, and there are special memorials erected to 8 soldiers from the UK and 3 from Canada who are known or to believe to be buried here, but their actual location of their graves has been lost. And there's one German soldier here as well, all on his own in plot 2. But the reason that we've come here today, the reason why I want to talk in this cemetery, is about one of those special memorials to a soldier that is believed to be buried here. And his name was Lance Corporal Harry Van Tromp. And he was serving with the 22nd Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers and killed in action not far from here near Vimy Ridge on the night of the 23rd to the 24th of May 1916. And he was aged 34.
Now, Harry at one time was a bell ringer at the Church of St. Mary Magdalene in Taunton in southwest England, in the county of Somerset. And what happened here was the Germans, in an attempt to disrupt the mining activity that was going on, they carried out a large-scale attack on the British trenches on Vimy Ridge on the 21st of May 1916. And the attack was intended to push the British back to the line held by the French prior to September 1915, and it means that they wouldn't be able to have access to the mine shafts that had been dug. Now, that German attack that night began at 7:45, and for most part they were able to make easy progress, as the British lines had all been obliterated by shell fire. On the right, the British were forced back to the road running at the base of the valley. The sappers took the precaution of manning the defences at Cabaret Rouge, where there's a big concentration cemetery there now, and that's on the west side of the valley. But the situation was one of confusion. The Broadmarsh crater on Vimy Ridge was secured, and that crater is still there. Now, the British then launched a counterattack at 2 o'clock in the afternoon that achieved nothing. An attack on the 23rd soon broke down, and in the end the British learned to live with the situation, especially as it became clear from aerial reconnaissance that they weren't going to get any further. And it was during that counterattack on the 23rd that Lance Corporal Van Tromp was killed. We've got an account of what was going on May the 23rd on that day from a Major Richard Johnston. He said, "Went up to the left sector to get the exact situation and make arrangements for the evening attack. The poor old 3rd Worcestershire has had a bad shelling in places, and one trench was full of bodies, and five more were knocked about close to me by a Minenwerfer. In the afternoon, was busy getting orders out, went across to Cabaret Rouge to arrange details with the brigade on our left who were making the big attack. From about 4:30 p.m. onwards, there was a tremendous bombardment, but I'm afraid the Germans were expecting the attack, as they put down an almost impregnable barrage, chiefly on the Suave Valley on our left, where I'm standing now. The regiment started their attack sharp at 8:25 p.m, captured the trench all right, but as the brigade on the left was unable to start on time owing to the enemy's artillery fire, their left was right in the air, particularly as we were a lot in front of the other brigade at the start. The result was they had a bad time for machine guns on their left, and in the end had to be content with holding on to the southern portion of the trench only." And as we said, it was at some stage that Harry was killed, and his death was reported in the Taunton local newspaper on the 7th of June, a couple of weeks after he died. It says, "Killed in action, officers tribute to a gallant soldier. Both in Taunton and Bridgewater, the news has been received with deep regret of the loss of a gallant young Somerset soldier in the person of Lance Corporal Harry Van Tromp, the 22nd Royal Fusiliers, who was killed in action on the 23rd. The first intimation was received by Alderman and Mrs. Van Tromp at Taunton in a letter from a captain in the deceased company." He wrote the letter on the 26th of May, 3 days after he died. And it says, "Dear Sir, I'm deeply sorry to have to tell you that your son was killed in action on the 23rd. As a soldier, he did his part splendidly in upholding the high standards of the battalion. All of us who knew him sincerely deplore his loss and console with you deeply in your sad bereavement. But in spite of our sorrow, we have a source of pride and lasting happiness in knowing that he died doing his duty as a brave soldier and serving the cause of king and country. Yours sincerely, Gerald Damon, Captain, Royal Fusiliers." The commanding officer of the battalion, he wrote a letter as well. He said, "I'm very sorry to have to announce to you the death of your son. He was killed on Vimy Ridge on the night of the 23rd. He was a most gallant fellow, liked by everyone, and we all miss him immensely. His company actually captured the German trenches. I personally knew him very well, and so feel he's lost more than anyone else. He was killed instantaneously, which is a great comfort." How many times have I read that in a podcast and wondered whether that was true? "I cannot speak enough of his coolness and gallantry. To you, the loss is irreparable, and I can do nothing in any way to lessen your sorrow. We soldiers all have to go through with it, and it's the example of heroes like your son that make us long to follow their example in the same cool, gallant manner.
You have my deepest sympathy. Yours truly, R. Barnard Baker, Lieutenant Colonel. Not only was Harry a bell ringer, he was a good sportsman. He played football for Bridgewater Albion Club. He was also a member of the golf club and a keen motorcyclist. And he joined up with the Royal Fusiliers in September 1940. He could have got a commission because of his father's position in society, but he turned that down to become an ordinary soldier. Although he didn't want to be an officer, he did become a lance corporal just before Christmas of 1915, when his company was coming out of the trenches. He had to cross a road which was being shelled by the enemy. A shell burst amongst his platoon, killing one man and severely injuring others, including him. Although wounded, he insisted on helping to bring under cover seven of his comrades. And for that gallant deed, he wasn't given a medal of any kind. He was given a lance corporal's stripe. Just 10 days before his death, he was home on leave with his parents in Taunton. And on the Sunday, he went to the church where he was the bell ringer, and he also visited Bridgewater. He was in the best of health and spirits and was warmly welcomed by the employees of the firm that he worked for, his father's business, among whom he was a great favourite because of his kind and generous nature. And that man's life was cut down a few hundred yards away from where I'm standing now at Vimy Ridge, where so many people visit, quite rightly, to pay honour to the Canadian divisions that came together to force the Germans off the top of that ridge. But much went on before that. We mustn't forget that. It was nearly a year before that happened that Harry von Trump lost his life up there on Vimy Ridge and was brought back here to be buried. We don't know exactly where he's buried now, but there's a headstone, and now there's a photograph in front of that headstone of him. It was a photograph that was taken on his last day in action in England. 6 days later, he died up there on Vimy Ridge. But we'll never forget him, will we? Once again, I place my hand on his headstone, and we thank him for his sacrifice.
A few minutes later, the frontline walkers appeared at the top of the valley and made their way down to the afternoon tea break. And I told them Harry's story, and I showed him the photograph, a copy of which I'll put on the podcast page of my website, terrystours.co.uk. And someone pointed out that in that photo that was taken on his last day in England, there was no smile. His mum and dad had that photo taken, but he couldn't force a smile for them. And his eyes, there was something about them, they were blank. He'd been out on the Western Front for something like 15 months before he came home for that last leave. Perhaps those eyes were looking back and seeing again what he'd already seen. Actions that we can't even imagine. Or perhaps those eyes were looking forward. And perhaps somehow he knew that he'd got less than a week to live. So the final day of the walk is mainly, thankfully for the walkers, downhill, beginning at the Vancouver Corner Canadian Memorial. They made their way to Pokerpel and then headed towards Tynecott. And before they got to Tynecott, they went through the village of Passchendaele, a small town, of course, which gives its name to that third Battle of Ypres. And as they made their way through those quiet roads surrounded by fields full of crops, some of which had been harvested and some had not, they were only disturbed by the odd tractor, or perhaps a local on their way about their business. The landscape is scattered with those farms that were rebuilt after the war, but those farms were there in 1917 when the New Zealanders, the Australians, the Canadians, the British tried to make their way through those low fields and up the Belvedere Ridge towards Passchendaele, towards where Tynecott is now. This was the worst experience, it said, that any British soldier or Commonwealth soldier has ever experienced. And as the walkers trundled along, chatting to each other, comparing blisters, wondering how long it would be to the next break, they crossed one of those small streams. They didn't even notice they'd crossed it. And this one was called the Ravebeek. I have in front of me an account of how the Canadians tried to cross that same ground in October of 1917. It says this: the road to the front would have caused anyone to abandon hope. One battalion war diarist reported that thousands of dead horses and mules are to be seen in the 4 mile stretch to the firing line. Large numbers of human bodies, which had been hurled from their graves by the bursting of large shells, add a very poignant note to the horror of the general surroundings. One of those soldiers from the Canadian Army was called Becker, serving with the 75th Battalion. He said, as he was squatting in a shell hole knee-deep in water, he and a pal waited, for they weren't sure what to do. He said the rain came down in torrents, and we sat there with our backs against the earth towards the Germans, listening to the whine and crash of shells all around us. We were about as miserable a pair as one could imagine. We had no idea where we were, who was in front, ahead of us, or where the line was. All we could do was sit there and wonder. We wondered many things. Just before 6 a.m. on the 26th of October, that thick mist that he talked about turned to rain, and at that moment the lead battalions moved out. In the trenches at the extreme left of the Canadian front, there was a Lieutenant Ray Warne. He was serving with the 4th Canadian Mounted Rifles, and he was waiting for the attack. He said that his troops were nearly frozen, soaked to the skin, and the rain coming down in torrents. At last, the barrage lifted and away we went. It was a sight one could never forget. Men dropped all along the line, but the rest struggled through the mud towards the pillboxes, where the machine guns spat a continuous stream of death. It was terrible to see the wounded holding their arms, begging for help, and yet be unable to help them. In the meantime, confusion had overtaken the operations south of the Ravebeek. Decline Cross straddled the boundary between the Canadian and the Australians, and therefore was a vulnerable spot. The 46th Battalion had captured it, but poor communication with the relieving unit allowed the Germans to reoccupy parts of the front line. And for 2 hours, the two sides scrapped and clawed over the shattered wood, and not till the following evening were the last of the Bavarians ejected from Decline Copse. Success for the men of the 72nd Battalion seemed even more unlikely. Ahead of them was the heavily defended Cress Farm, so well protected that there was only a narrow gap for the attacking companies to get through. Their capture of Cress Farm impressed Stephen Haig, and one can forgive the celebratory tone of the war diary. It said the Huns ran in all directions, and it is a certainty that they were completely demoralised. Hour after hour, shell rained down on the Canadians as their numbers were slowly whittled down. The rain and mud began to take a toll on their rifles, many of which were unserviceable. But they held on grimly, doggedly, and eventually were able to consolidate their gains. The wounded staggered and stumbled to regimental aid posts. An officer of the 10th Battalion described the men who made it back as pitiful. They were the lucky ones, for so many men never emerged. The 8th Battalion's war diarist reported that two men drowned trying to get back across the Ravebeek, not having the strength to cross that little stream. And as I said a few minutes ago, the frontline walkers crossed the Ravebeek. The road crossed the Ravebeek. It was covered by vegetation. They didn't even know they'd crossed it at that point, where men had drowned in the flooded banks of the Ravebeek. It took them about 15 minutes to walk that same ground up to Cress Farm. Little did they know the amount of bloodshed that it had cost in 1917 to go in exactly the same direction. As this account ends, I'll quote it, it says, Passchendaele was about sheer hard work and apparently superhuman endurance. And on they went. And then they made their way through Polygon Wood, and now the end of the walk was in sight. But they paused briefly in the Butts Cemetery within Polygon Wood, they paused at the grave of Lieutenant Harold Hill, an Australian soldier who had died on the 4th of October 1917, and I have in front of me an account of what happened to him. This was written by one of his comrades, Private Herbert Burge, who was in hospital in Chichester in Sussex, but came from Sydney in Australia. He said, "I helped to bandage Lieutenant Hill. He was so badly wounded in the head and hit almost all over the body too, that he could not have lived much more than an hour, if that. Afterwards, I heard that he lived for nearly 2 hours. He was unconscious. The wound in the head alone would have prevented his recovering. I had to leave him and go with a battalion who were advancing. He'd been hit by a shell during a heavy barrage. He died in a dressing station on the Menin Road and then buried in Polygon Wood in the Butts Cemetery after the war, reburied there. Nothing unusual about that, but his mum chose these words for his headstone, the family inscription. She chose the words, presumably the last words that he said to her when he left the family home on the other side of the world. He said, "I'm all right, Mother. Cheerio." Those are the words that the frontline walkers looked down on as they made their way out of the cemetery, through the wood, up onto the Menin Road, and down into Ypres at the Menin Gate, where the walkers were presented with their medals. They hugged each other. They looked at the 54,000 names of the missing. And now what we're going to do is the final part of the podcast, is to play to you the chat that I had with Alex Hale. If you remember, I mentioned that her father had been killed in Afghanistan in 2009. At lunch on the second day, I spoke to Alex. She spoke so eloquently. This is how she managed to express herself. So we're now at the Notre Dame de Lorette cemetery with about 44,000 French graves in that we're standing here looking at. There's a few flowers we can see. There's the big cathedral there, which is a spectacular setting to talk to. Would you like to introduce yourself then, Alex?
Of course,
you've
Terry.
Joined us on the frontline walk here.
Have indeed. My name is Alex Hale and I'm a beneficiary ambassador for the Army Benevolent Fund. And I've been really, really privileged to be asked to come and join the frontline walkers this year on this Western Front walk, to share the journey with them, and really see firsthand the cost and the impact of World War One.
And you've got a very personal connection with the Army because we're here to talk about your dad. Tell us about your dad's service in the Army.
Yeah, of course. My dad was in the Devon and Dorset Regiment. He joined around 1983 and he was killed in action in 2009 in Afghanistan while serving with 2nd Battalion, the Rifles. He was a late entry commissioned officer. And he absolutely adored his job, absolutely loved it, and was delighted when he received his commission, and it meant that he could stay in the army for a longer time.
And what was your life like? You have memories of your dad. You said you were 8 years old when you lost your dad.
Yeah, I was eight, so really quite young. My memories of my dad, therefore, are actually really innocent, and there's something quite pure about them. He loved to cycle and I absolutely loved sitting on the back of his bike, adding that extra weight, that extra challenge for those really steep hills he was trying to tackle, or going to rugby training. He was the coach for the regimental rugby team,
right.
Going to rugby training and cheering all of the boys on from the sidelines and, you know, really wanting to get involved.
You were like the mascot, were you?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. And it's funny now seeing all the other children of the teammates of that time. Mm. And yeah, I remember rugby tackling all these boys who now play for Ulster.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But I was in my dad's pocket when he was at home.
Your
I
daddy's
really was.
Girl.
Yeah, absolutely, a daddy's girl. And, you know, always that thing. My mum was quite relieved when he was at home because that question of, "Alex, who would you like to take you to bed tonight?" And it was always dad. So mum,
really?
She could have a sigh of relief and maybe go have that 15-minute cup of tea to herself in the evenings.
Peace and quiet without
But
you.
I was definitely daddy's girl, yeah.
And then what happened on that on that day?
Yeah, so Dad actually wasn't meant to be on patrol. So he'd been in Afghanistan at that point for about 4 months. They were deployed in the April. He had had some summer leave in the July. So we had a really nice 2 weeks together on the north coast of Northern Ireland. Yeah. And then he went back to Afghanistan. And within about 2 weeks, he was out on patrol. And he was meant to be in a desk job, but they'd had so many casualties and fatalities on that tour. Dad wanted to go out so that the boys, the soldiers, knew that he was on their side and sort of with them. And
that's leadership, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's natural leadership. He wouldn't want to be sat behind a desk, would he?
No, he hated it. He absolutely hated being behind a desk. And I think as well, he had so much experience behind him.
Mm.
And he'd done those years as a soldier. You know, he'd been the lance corporal, the corporal, the sergeant. He knew what everybody's responsibility was in and out, really.
Yeah.
And so he really just wanted to show up for the boys and be there with them.
Mm.
But sadly, while they were on a patrol, one of the boys stepped on an IED, and that was the first one that was hit.
Mm.
And so Dad went out to try and retrieve him, but then another IED went off.
Right.
And so one of the other very, very brave soldiers started screaming, "Who's going to help the boss? Who's going to help the boss?"
Mm.
And nobody went in. So that young chap went in to go and help Dad, and that's when they hit another IED that immediately killed the two soldiers. My dad survived the blast and died later that morning in Camp Bastion from his injuries. So quite the morning. I mean, that would have happened around 6 a.m. for them.
Afghan time.
And then we got a door knock just before midday. I was actually at a school summer scheme.
Right.
Mum was at home.
Was your mum on her own?
She was, yeah. My sister was doing work experience at a local newspaper. She was 16.
Mm.
So yeah, you know, end of her GCSEs, getting ready for sixth form. So I was doing some work experience. Mum was at home and thought something was strange because we normally received emails from Dad every morning and we hadn't received any emails that morning.
Mm.
And then Mum saw some people walking towards the front door and she knew.
Mm.
She knew what that door knock was going to be.
And that day changed your life forever then, didn't it? For all of you.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember getting home, my auntie and uncle had picked me up from summer scheme, which I thought was quite odd. That wasn't the plan. I hadn't been told at the start of that day that somebody else would be picking me up.
Mm.
And I got home and I was just so excited to show my auntie and uncle my new school shoes. We were 2 weeks out from the start of the new school year.
Right.
And Mum had to get quite stern with me to be like, "Alex, we need to go to your room and have a talk.
Right.
I need to chat to you." And so, yeah, she took me up to my room and she sat me down. She sort of held my hand and told me that Dad wasn't going to come home and that he'd
gone
to heaven.
That's the way she put it. I mean, this story, and we mentioned, yesterday we did a podcast a couple of weeks ago about children of the fallen from the Great War.
Mm.
And there was 380,000 children had that conversation with their parents. And I was trying to imagine as we read the stories what that was like, how it affected them, and I didn't realize at that stage that we were going to meet you and hear this story from you. I mean, can you put it into words how you felt as an eight-year-old? Could you comprehend it?
I really couldn't comprehend it. I mean, we were in Northern Ireland, so I didn't really have a proper understanding of what Dad's job was, because that wouldn't have been particularly safe, because you don't know who I'd be at school with.
In
and
Northern
stuff.
Ireland,
so
yeah.
I knew Dad was away with work. I had a little atlas, actually, and Dad would show me the pages of the atlas where he was going, and we would dog-ear it so I could go find it.
That's a nice memory, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So
he
spent a lot of time with me doing stuff like that. So I knew where he was, but I had no idea what was going on. And because of how difficult it was out there at the time, Mum never had the TV on, so I didn't see any of this coming up on the news either. I had no idea.
Mm.
So it was really quite a shock because then all of a sudden I got flung into this world that was very army orientated. You know, we had the repatriation.
And that put you in the public eye, didn't it, family, you said?
Yeah, it did. You know, there wasn't many serving soldiers from Northern Ireland who were killed in Afghanistan. And if they were, it was kept relatively low profile due to security reasons. I think just given the fact that my dad was the longest serving soldier to be killed in Afghanistan, there came a certain level of attention with that.
Right.
And so we had journalists sort of just loitering around the house.
Really? And were you aware
onwards.
Of that?
I wasn't super aware of it until Dad's funeral.
Right.
And then we couldn't go back to our house.
Really?
That evening. We had to stay in one of the army camps in Northern Ireland because we couldn't get home.
On top of everything else, you just want to go home in that situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. And then you turned to the Army Benevolent Fund, or the Army Benevolent Fund found you, which has brought you on the walk this time. And you're putting your legs and brain and everything else through pain to say thank you to the Soldiers Charity for helping at the time then.
Absolutely, yeah. The ABF definitely found us, I think with the help of some people from my dad's regiment, but we were in a really difficult situation where the MOD had lost Dad's will, and so we were really in a lot of trouble actually trying to figure out how we were going to financially deal with everything, because it would be a long time before any of that had been figured out. And I was at a prep school near Dad's work, and there was a concern that I wouldn't be able to stay there. And like I said, Dad died 2 weeks out from the start of the new school year.
So you're ready to go.
And the thought of having to move schools and try and make new friends and develop relationships with new teachers and everything else was really quite overwhelming as a child. And Mum was trying not to tell me too much, but didn't want me to be blindsided at the start of the school year by moving. So I was being drip-fed information when it felt appropriate, but it was quite unsettling for me, extremely unsettling for Mum, trying to find a solution. Yeah, the memories of what happened in August 2009 do feel quite distant and a bit blurry, but the one thing I've really benefited from is the sense of community that the Army Benevolent Fund and the purpose that it's given my family over recent years to stay connected to that Army family and that Army community, which has in turn helped me stay connected with my dad and the people that he would have known. I've met a lot of people along this journey and on this frontline walk actually, who have crossed over with my dad at different points in his career, whether it was his phase one training or his last ever job in Afghan
That's another connection with him, isn't it? And I think this is why it's very important for the Army Benevolent Fund, for fundraisers and volunteers like myself, because it's not just about the serving soldiers of today, but it's about the whole Army family. We're the national charity of the British Army, so we're there to support the soldiers, the veterans, but also their immediate families. And Alex is a great example of how we've done that, and it's meant that you've able to you know, grow up and have a good life in memory of your dad. And tomorrow night we're going to be doing something very special, aren't you? Because you're going to be you tell them what you'll be doing tomorrow night at the Menin Gate.
Thank you to Terry and the wonderful team at the charity. I will be laying a wreath at the Menin Gate. This feels extremely poignant, actually. I think sometimes it's easy to forget with everything going on what the cost and the impact of war can be, and this walk and this journey has been a really stark and poignant reminder of what that cost can look like and the impact that it can have. So to be able to lay a wreath at Menin Gate is a real, real honour.
So we'll be remembering your dad in the shadow of the names of 54,000 men that died during the First World War in the Ypres area that have no known grave. While we're doing that, we'll be remembering your dad very specially.
Thanks, Terry.
So yes, we were talking about the Army Benevolent Fund and how they helped you again, and I think that's a good example of how the charity helps not just soldiers and veterans but their families as well, because you're part of the, and you still feel part of the Army family, you said, didn't you?
Yeah, I do, and the charity have been a wonderful source of strength and support for my family. They were obviously there in the initial days, but that was 16 years ago now,
and I'm
still here and still able to be part of that community, which makes a lifetime of difference when you're on that road of grief.
But I think further evidence that your dad is still with us is what you're going to read to us now, because we're going to hear his words now, aren't we, spoken by you.
Yeah. Dad was quite a good writer, and he would often write poems and limericks and stuff for Mum, me and my sister. So this is one of the last poems that he ever wrote, and we didn't find it until after he was killed. It was on his iPod that he had with him in Afghanistan. So we found this when his stuff got home. The time has come to depart for my duty. No thoughts of blind patriotism or of queen and country. Just thoughts for my family, who I leave behind, and thoughts for the boys and each day what they will find. For myself, there is no sentiment, just a little despair, but not of worry or concern or of any real fear. Despair as a father about to abandon you for some length, when I should be protecting you and sustaining you with strength. Not there at night to peep around the door or to guide you through your trials until you prosper for sure. Your lives will continue, and you have so much to achieve. I hope you understand, and pardon me my leave. Despair is a husband, separated from home and wife, separated from my reason and purpose, how will I fill my life? The prospect of this parting has opened the heart, rekindled those feelings, rarely felt so strongly since the start. Overwhelmed with emotion, which is tinged with sorrow, my soul will be aching and longing for tomorrow.
That's the second time I've heard it, but it's still a tough listen. I'm sure everyone feels the same way that's listening to that. But I think that there's no doubt that your dad would be, well, he's still here. He'll be looking down on you. He'll be very proud of what you've achieved already, and you've still got lots more to achieve. And also, you told me that your sister had qualified as an accountant, so I'd be very proud of her as well.
Just this week. So, yeah, I think that that middle stanza, the one that starts with despair as a father, it's a real source of, like, where we can get some grit and motivation from as sisters, I find, because it's never not going to be relevant.
No.
So it's quite powerful that way, and it's something really quite nice in Dad's words that we can carry with us.
Very much so, yeah. It's a wonderful tribute to him. So thank you very much. You've got to get walking again now, so I better not keep you any longer.
Do you go stretch those calves before we get more hills. Yeah.
And we'll catch up with you at the Menningate tomorrow.
Absolutely. See you there.
Thank you.
Earlier on in the podcast, I mentioned about the 75th Battalion of the Canadian Army, and their Lieutenant Colonel was a man called Gustavus Beckett. And he'd been born in 1869. So when he was killed on the 1st of March 1917, he was 48 years old. And he was buried in Villa's Station Cemetery that we visited on the second morning of the frontline walk. And he came from Toronto in Canada and arrived in the UK in April of 1916 before proceeding over to the Western Front in August of 1916. But he was killed in action while trying to rally his troops during the disastrous raid near Carency on the 1st of March 1917. Well, why do I mention him? Because after we left Villa's Station Cemetery, I went up to the village of Villa's and I discovered a wall outside of the local church, and on it was some graffiti. There was the 75th Battalion's cap badge in the shape of that maple leaf with Toronto underneath. And whoever had placed that graffiti on the wall had also listed Lieutenant Colonel Beckett as their commanding officer, which told me that he was a much-loved leader of men. As was Mark Hale, Alex's much-loved dad, killed in action in 2009. So I think what we'll do this week is we're not going to play the last post. Sometimes I try and find some music that's appropriate to what we've been talking about. And this song is sang by Luther Vandross, and he called it Dance With My Father. And I'm sure the lyrics of this are very appropriate for Alex and all of the other people that have lost their father in warfare down the centuries. Spin me around till I fell asleep.
with my father again. When I and my mother would disagree, to get my way I would run from her to him. He'd make me laugh just to comfort me, yeah, yeah. Then finally make me do just what my mama said. Later that night when I was asleep, never dreamed that he would be gone from me. If I could steal one final glance, one final step, one final dance with him, I'd play a song that would never, ever end. 'Cause I'd love, love, love to dance with my father. Dance with